Velkommen. Det fint å se at det så mange som har funnet veien. Jeg snakker litt grann norsk I starten, but now I changed to English. And we are going to introduce the panel. But before, I also want to say that Hilde Hunolvatn from the Norwegian Council of for Africa, she's here. She's taking notes. She's part of us and she's staying very much present, but she's going to take and write the input. If you want to ask questions after, or any comment, or any proposals, we're going to tape it and write it. So your presence is very important. Okay, Hilde, would you come up here and take a seat? And then we also introduce Tekle Heimanot. He's associate professor at NTNU. Please welcome him. And Sadiq Salim, he's a Kenyan journalist and the one who invented the diasporic dialogue. Please take a seat. And Tendai Rokones, which is a public speaker and a yoga teacher and she's clever on self-development, as I understand. Okay, we give the word to Hilde.
Hello. Thank you so much, Guri. So I'm just going to give some introductory remarks and also tell you a bit more about who we are as an organization, and then I'm going to leave my seat to Guri. It's very nice to see you here. Thank you to Ethiopisk Fellesskap, who I've been in contact with, and you have showed up man strong, very good. Man and women strong. And thank you to the rest of you who have showed up. So I work for an organization called the Norwegian Council for Africa, and we are based in Oslo, but we also have a group in Tromsø, and we are thinking that maybe we can also manage to have a group in Trondheim. We shall see. And right now we are working with the new Africa strategy that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs are working on. So the new Africa strategy, the last one was published in 2007. Obviously, a lot has happened since then. There has been a lot of changes in the geopolitical landscape. There are new actors now active in African countries. But African countries also have more options. It's no longer that the West has all the power in that relationship. And two of the issues that for us in the Council have been important is the increasing debt that many African countries are experiencing now, but also the climate crisis and the responsibility of countries such as Norway to give climate adaptation financing, for example. But one of the most important things to us in general, but also now in the input we are going to give the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, is the involvement of the African diaspora. Of course, the diaspora is not a homogeneous group. It's very many different interests, different political affiliations. Some groups we meet, they are only interested in working with the cultural and social aspects, and that's completely fine. But there are many organizations and individuals that have a lot of resources, they have networks, they have a lot of cultural and political knowledge about different countries that are absolutely an untapped resource for the Norwegian Foreign Affairs and the Norwegian society as a whole. So this is one thing that we are constantly reminding the ministry about, and this is also something we'll hear more about in the discussions here today. The last time we really heard about the inclusion and the use of the diaspora in developing Norwegian foreign policy, it was also back in 2007 when Jonas Gahr Støre was the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and they launched a new stortingsmelding, I don't know what it is in English, where they focused on the diaspora as a resource. Since then, not much has been done. It seems it was kind of a forgotten topic. There have been some research done about it from individuals in different research institutions, but not. We haven't seen this develop and progress into something that we had hoped for. So I hope and I know that we'll get a lot of good input here today. I'm excited to hear both the input from the panelists, but also from you in the audience. And as I said, I'll be writing it down so that we compile everything and send it to the ministry before Christmas. Thank you so much.
We'll have it. We'll have 5 to 7 minutes. Each of them will have their paper where they state their points and give input to us. And after, then we are going to make some questions to elaborate a little bit on the topic they have. And then you are free to start the dialogue or input questions or proposal. So, okay, let's start. Tekle.
For me, okay. Yes, my name is Tekle Haymanot Woldemikel, but you can call me Tekle. I'm an associate professor at NTNU. I'm a human geographer by training. And I am originally from Tigray in Ethiopia. And I have been researching several multiple countries in Africa for the last few years. As a PhD student doing research in Kenya and Tanzania in relation to conservation politics, and over the last 3 years following the crisis in Tigray in Ethiopia. I was very intrigued by the fact that I'm labeled as a diaspora in Norway, whereas I'm also addressed as a diaspora back home. So like it's a two-way kind of like title for me. And I should start from by stating the fact that we, like Africa as a continent, is going through landslide change in terms of the geopolitical changes that are taking place around the continent over the last few years. And my colleagues in Bergen at the Politics Institute in Bergen have a book where they state that Africa is sort of like backsliding in terms of democratic achievements in terms of democracy that has happened over the last couple of decades. So they say that there is a retreat of democracy and respect of the fundamental principles of that the West has often been pushing for over many years, and we also witness the collapse of states in many African countries. Like the Sahel region is now, well, basically ungovernable, considering the changes that are taking place. Like Sudan is in a state of total war. And from Sudan, the port of Sudan, to all the way to the border of Senegal, all those countries are going through a lot of change that many may consider as state collapse. And my own country, Ethiopia, has been going through a devastating crisis over the last several years now, including the crisis that has been going on in Tigray over the last 3 years. And those are not exclusively African crises. We often hear these African solutions for African problems, but those are not African problems. They are fundamental outcomes of global geopolitical shifts that are triggering conflicts over the region, because of global competition for access and hegemony over the region. We see emerging powers like the Gulf states, Russia, Iran, China, and other countries trying to establish themselves as a new hegemony over the region, whereas the Western states competing and trying to defend control over the region. The result is that you have those kind of crises, the crisis of power vacuum and insecurities. Another result of that is we see the democratic backsliding, where fundamental principles or like human rights and human dignity are being abandoned in order to secure access to the region. So Western states are basically going following the same footprints as China and Russia, and abandoning the basic principles that they often claim to guard. And the question here is, how do we ensure that Norway doesn't follow the same sort of like race to the bottom kind of competition as the rest of the world, as the rest of the Western world, in terms of human rights and human dignity and the fundamental principles of human rights? And that is where the role of the diaspora comes in. So how do we engage the African diaspora in Norway in order to make sure that our policies don't end up abandoning the respect for human dignity, basically? And how do we make sure that Norwegian investments and trade and aid and other kind of engagements in Africa don't come at the cost of human rights, at the cost. How do we make sure that we follow the same rules that we do here when our companies go to Africa, to African states? And that is, I think, what we will discuss today, and I look forward to discussing with that.
Thank you. We take the questions and the input after, but you can take notes, you just follow and you just prepare yourself to ask. So now we go on with Sadiqe.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. My name is Sadiq Salim Ndamwe. I am a journalist from Kenya. I hold dual citizenship, having lived here for 12 years now. So it was quite a privilege to be invited to this podium. And I don't think I have so much input to give anyway, but being a journalist, my job is to keep the authorities that be in check. So I prefer to pinpoint on the holes. And when I got invited by Hilde, I went through this the old Norwegian strategic document as regarding Africa, and I can see that whatever is there actually is good as it is. I don't think it needs any change. But if I had a choice personally, I would say that I don't think Africa really needs aid. What Africa needs is trade, and what Africa needs is respect. We don't need pity. And I'm afraid that this is exactly what is happening, because I feel that Africa is being toiled like a small child. You know, we are poor. We admit that, and I know that some of the reasons that led to this poverty is through the historical injustices that were meted on Africans, which I don't think the Western world really understands the effect this has had on Africa. So all this that we are undergoing now is as a result of the infliction made to us by the West. So I feel that the document as it is talks about self-sustainability, which in all sectors, energy sector, healthcare, education, all the important factors. But I feel like if need be that we have to address these intermediate issues, then that's when we should accept the aid. But the aid should be accepted in a mutual respect, not out of pity, not give us aid because you're afraid of the repercussions of what is going to happen to the West. You know, I've seen situations whereby aid is being given to counter migration, simply because Europe is afraid that, yeah, if we don't do this, then we're going to have a bunch of Africans flocking into Europe, you know. So unfortunately, when you look at the Norwegian politic, it's also pointing towards the same trajectory. And I think that these are issues that we have to highlight. Regarding my organization, Diasporic Dialogue, what informed my decision to found this organization. For those of you who don't know, Diasporic Dialogue is a podium is a platform for Africans to share their experiences, you know, triumphs and challenges. So being a journalist, we are still in our initial stages now, but what we intend to do is to have a YouTube channel that will be highlighting on different challenges that the Africans encounter here. Of course, first and foremost is the discriminatory issue, which I think is number one. And regarding the aid talk, I think this is one of the things that maybe the Norwegian Council should forward to the authorities, that charity begins at home. So before we talk about Africa, let's talk about the inclusivity of the Africans here, because Africans who are here still don't feel like they have a share of the cake. We still feel like sort of excluded. So these are the issues that have to be addressed. There's a lot of stereotype prejudice still going on in Africa with the impunity, that sort of make me enraged. And I'll give an example of a program that was aired on NRK, like in 2017, a program called Skorungen. And Skorungen is about fishermen, people competing, contesting on a boat to like their debut in the fishing industry. And they have different competitions, like how fast they maybe can chop off the head of a cod fish, trying to smell who can smell what fish that this fish. So the particular one I'm talking about, just to cut this story short, is about a competition whereby the contestants were supposed to sort the various grades of fish, of cod fish, and there was the first grade of the fish was called Italia, and the second one was called Tipo B, and the third one, the lowest grade, was called Africa. And what is actually disgusting in this show is that one of the contestants goes, picks up a piece of toshk, smells it, and then she puts it in the African thing, and she says that has definitely got to be Africa. And then the presenter is asking, how did she come up with a conclusion like that? And she goes like, yeah, it because the smell is disgusting. And it's, you know, it's so pungent that the moment I just inhaled that smell, I knew that definitely has to be Africa. This really got me enraged, and I tagged NRK on their Facebook page, and I told them, this is not right. You are a national broadcaster. You are supposed to be unifying and, you know, informing people and you know, embracing diversity. So why would you come up with such a show? Why wouldn't you censor things like this? The note that I got back was, Din sak anotet me venli hilsen per.
Wow.
And I was like, is that all you have to say? You know, I was so enraged, I wanted to write something about it, but I didn't know how to act, so I just forgot about it. Last year, there was a repeat of the program. So where are we headed as a country? Mm-hmm. I have so many examples, but I will come up with more talk as we progress. So basically, in a nutshell, that is what I do. I'm a journalist.
Basically, I want to say that we have to make consciousness how African African background are integrated.
Yeah, I think because if we are to take part in the betterment of this document, then we also have to be comfortable here. Because we as diasporans have to play a role in it, because we are the leverage, we are the equilibrium between Africa and Norway. So we have we deserve the respect first before we can roll out to the other side. Yeah.
Okay, Tande.
Hello, my name is Tindai Angela Jamka Rokunez. Thank you very much, Sadiq, for getting me enraged right before I come on. So, my name is Tindai Angela Jamka Rokunez. I am a Zimbabwean born, but consider myself a global citizen. I come from the richest continent on this planet. We have got lithium, gold, iron ore, whereby the whole global financial system was actually backed up by gold reserves. But I've never seen another continent that actually does have gold, such as Africa. If you can name me one, I will sit back and wait. I also come from the richest country with Victoria Falls UNESCO heritage sites, the most beautiful people that have humor that will make you curl up where your ribs will begin to hurt from laughing so much. I am a beautiful woman. See, enrage can do something to you. A beautiful African woman who is pregnant with her first child, who will be born around Valentine's Day next year, which is why it is incredibly important to me that I sit here to you today as a proud African woman living in Norway as a diasporan and speaking up to the eloquence, the injustices, and the supreme honor that it actually is to come from this continent. Because for all too many decades and centuries, Africans have been subjugated, exploited, and told that we are not good enough. And instead, we come from a continent that has over 3,000 ethnicities. A little fact about Zimbabwe. We have 16 national official languages. Those are more official languages than anywhere in the world. And that is what is held in Zimbabwe. Inini ndino taura Chishona. Shona is my first language, but I tell you, I can whip out any English language and spin it around my tongue and have you running for the hills. I'm not quite there in Norwegian yet. But give me 2 years. But my name is Tanaya. I'm a yoga teacher, well-being curator, international public speaker. You might be wondering what a yoga teacher is doing now on a panel talking about Africa. Well, I first started off wanting to become a diplomat. My grandfather was the first ambassador from Zimbabwe to France, UNESCO, and the Vatican. And he was the first person to ever tell me that you will get more from travel, more of an education from travel rather than by sitting inside a classroom or from the books that you read. You will get them from the libraries of people that you meet, because each person that you meet will tell you stories. By the time that he had passed away, my heart completely sank. I was studying law and global and international studies in Australia. It was around that same time that I learned that it was more important for me to talk to people on the ground and work with people's emotions and bodies and find out exactly who they were coming from different countries rather than to sit and be a diplomat. I also, unfortunately, found out how much diplomats make. I don't think I should tell you. Especially African diplomats. I look at nations the same way I look at bodies within a yoga class. I look at their body structure. I think about the dignity of people. I think about how we talk to people. And it is apparent to me in my young life and to every single person that is sitting here today that the media tells us that Africans are poor and suffering. Now, what would that do if you're talking to a person and talking into their face constantly saying that? Unfortunately, if you talk to somebody as if they are a dummy, they will respond to you in time as if they are. Africans are incredible. And the aid that we are giving has been nothing but dead aid, which is a coin that was termed by Dambisa Moyo. Dambisa Moyo, an economist who also sits as a lord within the British system at the moment. What Norway should be doing with this new Africa strategy, and this is where I agree with you, Sadiq, there's nothing necessarily wrong with what it was before. But the issue that I have is that we are not bringing in the change makers and innovators, the diamonds in the rough that are on the continent, but also in the diaspora. It is people like who have organizations within Stavanger, Oslo, Trondheim, who will tell you the players and the major players on the ground who have ideas that are able to flourish that Norway is able to fund. Instead, we are coming in and only talking about big deals whilst coming and still hiding our hands without talking about the neo-colonization and forms of exploitation that are still occurring on the ground. There's no way that I cannot lie to you and talk to you about Congo. We know what's happening in Congo with cobalt, iron ore, but yet we still sit here in our cell phones, we still see children vaping. There is a huge push towards policies and change, but I think that the Western countries tend to make it seem as though it is in their best interest. That they have systematically destabilized African countries. The only ways that I would implore this new strategy to continue is if there's fair price discovery in terms of trade, authenticity, honesty, mutual respect, and a connection that is formed that does not make another human being feel as though they are being taken advantage of. Maya Angelou said, people will not remember what you say, but they will always remember how you made them feel. And Africans feel enraged.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And that is the fact that even the Norwegian Foreign Ministry has to deal with the understanding of self-awareness in Africa. That is a new wave going on just now. As you also, Tekla, mentioned about Sahel. They have 4 or 5 military coups. And for instance, Mali, the country that I know, people are so happy now that France are out. And people, they have they trust the future. They're changing the constitution. And they also started to use their local language, Bambara, as the official language. And they are stating an example how it will be when they nationalize the gold mines and all the natural resources, being totally aware of how rich the country is. And that is something, maybe is that why the foreign ministry want diaspora to come now with input, because they have, I don't know, they have gained a new consciousness. They even say that, okay, France, they have to change the strategy, the neo-colonial, or the colonial powers, colonialistic powers, they have to change the strategy. But Norway, too, has a special interest in Africa, and that is oil. So I think it's very difficult to discuss the strategy without taking in account the Norwegian interests, and to be honest about that, because it's under-communicated how much money Norway takes out of the continent. So what Norway give in this moment, it's earmarked to Africa at 7 billion, or a little bit more maybe. And it's 1.6 going to, this and that. But actually, I agree totally with Sadiqa and also with you that be stunned, that is a concept from the north. Because in the end, diaspora, it's the diaspora who send money support to their families. That is huge, a lot more important than any kind of be stunned to Africa, in my point of view. I don't know what you think about that. So if we talk about this, and it's very difficult to say what in which area should we support or give help. But we have to think. We have to think now. What kind of the money that Norway have accessible for, or that is possible to share and put into some areas? We have to try to think about that now. So I just. Any one of you who can think about something that you find important, where should we channel the small money that the budget has, some of the billions? Yeah.
If I must start, I think yes, you're right. Like the development,
development aid.
Yeah, development aid is. I mean, it's important, but it's not the central, especially with the change that we are witnessing to these days. Development assistance or aid isn't necessarily the center, or it shouldn't be the center of the discussion. The discussion is about trade and investment and country-to-country relations, people-to-people relations. And the question is what kind of relations do we want? What kind of investments, what kind of conditions for investments do we want to have? So the conditions for investment. So how do we want a company that's based in Oslo to invest in Trondheim and not abuse the people in Trondheim? How do you want the same principles to apply when they go to Addis to invest in Ethiopia? Or what kind of trade relations do we want? What kind of deals do we want? So I think that's the ground for the task that we, the ground for the kind of relations that we want to have. The money for like assistance, like development assistance, is of course it's important, but it's not like the central aspect
absolutely
of this.
Absolutely not. Yeah.
And that's also why I in the beginning when I mentioned about the race to the bottom, like how because of the geopolitics, because of the shift in global power relations, how Western states are sort of like. Even though there were a lot of problems with the way Western states put conditions on aid and investment before, there were at least principles that we thought were important, protecting like human rights, principles of human rights and governance and democracy. And my fear is that we are losing those principles in the process whereby Western states are sort of following the footsteps of China and Russia. And I think that's one of the conditions that has to be underlying in the Norwegian strategy for Africa is that we need to maintain some kind of principles when we engage with African states and African governments. And that doesn't mean that Norway should dictate how Kenya should govern itself. It doesn't mean that Norway should dictate how South Africa should be and all that. But to sort of like have a principle that Norwegian investments should invest in this under these kind of conditions, under the conditions that doesn't resemble like the what we see in Congo, that under the conditions that we see that we have in Ethiopia, the situation that we have in Ethiopia today. So that's
yeah. What we go for trade, not aid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but even trade has to have some kind of principle. So the reason why I brought the example of company from Oslo investing in Trondheim is we have principles in Norway. We have laws that a company couldn't abuse the workers. It couldn't abuse. It couldn't invest in a. You couldn't buy a share in a company that has very abusive relationships with its workers or has polluting effect in the neighborhood where it invests. And the same principle should apply when investment takes place across borders, across continents.
Hmm. Let me just state one example. I guess that most of you noticed that it was a military coup in Niger. And short time after, the French people or French power were kicked out of the country. Short time after, they could start to take prices on uranium at the same level as they did in Canada for the first time, because there are so many layers of the hands of the European interests that make it impossible to make a fair price. So that is an example of why it's so important for these countries, especially now the French earlier colonies. And I guess it will happen in Mali and the other countries like Burkina Faso, and we have Guinea-Bissau. Guinea-Conakry, sorry. Mm-hmm. But they are all together, there are five. So if you think about the Norwegian interests also, if you think about the business interests of Norway, that I think they are far bigger than the interest of a corporation. I'm sorry to say so as a Norwegian, but I've been living and working in Africa for many, many, many years. And in the countries where they are, interests from some country, there are. It's also always something hidden under. Now they have very big interests from Norway in West Africa, and we know that they have discovered a lot of oil. And in from Norway, we have, I think it's 45 companies, oil companies in Africa by now. So okay, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah? I wanted to just come in and add on to what you had said about not only just the principles, because I agree with that, having principles in place and a value system as to how Norway actually approaches different African countries as a good forms of diplomacy. And from my understanding, good forms of diplomacy also come into the cultural understandings of what each country holds, because that shows the respect factor. The late Desmond Tutu, he said that Africa's greatest gift to the world will be through Ubuntu. Ubuntu is a philosophy that says, I am because we are. But that's the same philosophy that tended to get Africa into a lot of the problems that we have. But inside those principles are mutual respect, understanding, self-sufficiency, and ideologies that uphold Africans first. Because exactly what we're talking about with the uranium, that was one of the very first times I think the world properly saw the hands of Europeans and the West coming in and taking, with the price discovery not in place. And that was the first time that it was not hidden, it was in plain sight, and nobody could do what a lot of Westerners tend to do, which is gaslight and completely invalidate the experiences of Africans, and especially main business actors on the continent. There are multitudes of incredible businessmen and women on the continent that are doing incredible things but get cut down at the knees by the poor infrastructure, the infrastructure of deals that the West comes in with. So with this, I do believe, I do hope that Norway can structure deals, especially within oil and gas, and even going into environmental change with climate change, so that it is, again, benefiting Africans. I wanted to point out, because you had asked which industry and which sector I believe that would be most important, and I think most imperative and most important at the moment is environmental and indigenous land rights. Because it has come from most indigenous countries of understanding about the land, being in connection with the land, and putting the land first. You know, within Norway, there's friluftsliv. Within African nations, we have got certain things such as totems. Your totem is an animal, or it is the way you honor a tree. It is embedded within the culture, how you treat the land in order how much you excavate from it, which is a complete difference to what I've seen with that the West is doing, where as soon as there's a dollar sign, it is let's go and run. Let's go see how much we can get from it. And I think that, again, that comes from a cultural understanding of understanding the principles that we go with to a country to say, this is how we wish to deal with your land. It's a respect factor. And one of the people that is one of my great heroes that talks about this is the late Wangari Maathai. So, you know, it's embedded within each African about how we treat the land. That should be part of the principle.
Let's just remember, Wangari, she won the Nobel Peace Prize 2004 for tree planting. Enormous, she was trying to make a big, huge plantation. Yeah. Wasn't that?
Yes. Yep. Yes, correct. She was just in Oslo, and her her speech that she gave is definitely something that I believe that every single person should watch. Her acceptance speech in Oslo for her peace prize, for her prize.
I think I also just would like to stress on the fact of trade, you know. Because if you look at the history of aid in Africa, I mean, the word aid has been there since time immemorial. And when you try to look at the changes, the impact it has had is almost zero. So I don't think no country in the world has ever become rich through aid. You know, instead, what is happening is that. Because we also have our flaws as Africans, and one of them is the bad leadership. Unfortunately, when this aid comes to Africa from government to government, it never trickles down to the common man. And I think what we should be trying to shed light on is how that aid can trickle down to the common man, because only the shoe wearer knows where it pinches the most, and the person at the bottom will know how to invest this money in a proper way. And through this, all these issues like education and you'll create jobs, you know, you'll be able to educate your kids and people, everybody will be comfortable. So there are cases whereby through corrupt deals in Africa, and I'll mention my country, Kenya, where I come from, you see that the politicians, most of this money that is meant for the aid and most of the tax money ends up in people's pocket, and instead of creating the jobs, maybe, you know, it would have been fair even to steal that money and buy or open an industry, then at least you will create job opportunities. But most of them take this money, and what they end up building is an apartment, employing one caretaker. So all the money ends up in his pocket, you know. So all these things are killing Africa. So I think what we should be trying to shed light on is the peasant. How does the money get down there?
That is an interesting perspective. I have been thinking about when I see so many clever African youth looking for jobs, why don't we have startup fundings? Big startups in all the poor countries. Why don't we channel all the money from Europe into the startups and they can make their own jobs? That is what I've been thinking. That can be an alternative or something interesting if you talk about aid. because I've seen how microfinance worked for poor women, and I've also written a book called "The Almisetil Vandihet" about that. So I've been seeing the experience in Bangladesh and so on. But people need access to capital. Even if they don't have credibility in the capitalistic banks, there are fundings that people need to create their own business. So that is my point. That is my idea. And I wanted to see that you're nodding. So maybe you wanted to elaborate a little bit on that.
Yes, actually, yeah? I would love to. You can see I'm nodding so that my head might almost fall off over here. But I actually have direct... not education, but experience with this, which is when I was working in Australia, in Sydney, I worked for a company called Spark International. Spark International empowered change makers and diamonds in the rough from Papua New Guinea, South Africa, and Kenya. During this time, there was a group of young Africans who loved to just see what was happening on the continent, and I was the person that got the applications coming in from these countries, where it wasn't even just capital that people would say that they needed, but even just web services, understanding how to code, how do we get this up, and a lot of things that people in the West would know how to do and have access to, but we're just sending it over. And during this time, it was a girl named Wawira Njuru. And Wawira Njuru just had an idea, a dollar and a dream, as they say. She said that she wanted to do something so that children were able to get a meal per day at school. Today, Wawira has now got multiple kitchens in Kenya, and I think she's going to be expanding soon. And I think she actually serves 750,000 to 1 million children a day.
Wow.
A day, and she's done this in the past 8 years. And I think that this is where it begins. It is having a fund for change makers, no questions asked. What is your idea? How are you able to implement it? People coming in and finding out, okay, for 6 months, this is your goal. Incubator programs for Africans. Africans have got burst with ideas. I mean, the storytelling you hear, the emphasis, and we know about, you know, local solutions to local problems or to global problems, but what about their creativity? And I'm not talking about even creativity in business strategies, but even on the side of the road. Have you ever sat and seen what somebody's able to make out of a piece of timber? And the mahogany, the toys that are made, from tins, even the artists, the designers, all of the poets, the storytellers, all of this bubbles from a depth that I think is lacking, and it can be shown through capital, through a fund, through microfinancing, a fund, incubator programs. And if anybody is setting this up, I would love to be a part of it, or I will be a part, or I'll make it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In academia, I know that you are looking more like the structural problems, and you have a different approach,
yeah,
and more critical to microfinance and things like that.
No, I was actually going to comment on that. Like, so the way I see, since I have been building up earlier, the way I see it from the way governments like Norway and like the EU, for example, has a Africa, like they call it Global Gateway. So it's the EU dealing with the AU and member states. So it's state-to-state kind of deals. And that kind of took away all the pressure that was there before to support civil society organizations, to support like grassroots movements before, like using donor finances before. And that now kind of like lifted everything to state-to-state relationship. And that's very, very counterproductive, and in the long term wouldn't have that much effect. So like he was saying, it will end up like the funding, the climate finance, for example, or climate change, it will end up in the pockets of the state, which will invest it in whatever it wants to do, like even in lethal weapons that it used to kill people. It will invest it in whatever it wants. So I think what's missing is lower level engagement despite whoever is in power. Like, so the Norway-Kenya relationship shouldn't depend on who is in power in Nairobi. It should, Norway to Kenya is like a relationship between people, the people of Norway and the people of Kenya. Mm-hmm. And then you have the capital, the finances, the capital movements between the two countries that are embedded in the social system in both countries. And that requires the kind of investments that she's talking about. Like we need to sort of like have better knowledge of what people are doing in those countries and how to trade and how to connect with the people on the ground. And the diaspora comes in that. Like we are helpful. Like where we are, like myself, and I'm an academic, so I write about these kind of things. I analyze, I produce knowledge regarding that, and my knowledge could be useful in designing things. And there are like a lot of people who know what's going on in their societies back home, and who have ideas about what kind of investments would be useful, would be more productive, and. So that's why it's necessary to engage the diaspora in Norway. Mm-hmm. Not we're not just resources, but we we could be helpful in many ways in building the relation between people mm-hmm. to people.
Mm-hmm. We have plenty questions, plenty topics, but shall we open up and invite you to come with any comment, question, or idea, and then we go back and we keep on talking again. We just want to open up to take in. Yeah. Please tell your name. And
Thank you very much for the interesting discussion. My name is Mulgita. I'm Ethiopian. I'm a hydrologist, hydropower engineer, and working at Multiconsult Norway. I say that I lived here in Norway for many years. The first time I was introduced to Norway was in 2002, but I went back and came.
Keep your mic a little bit closer.
Yeah, I was in 2002, and then I went back after I finished my studies and came back and do another study, and then now I'm living here for 16 years, working for a Norwegian company, which is also international company. I must say that I have never seen this strategy of document. I should have seen it before I came here, but unfortunately I haven't seen it. But I think these guys have explained it very, very good, and I appreciated that. The African diaspora, there are brilliant people here in Norway working in different sectors at universities, consulting companies. I think they're the finest minds of Africa living in the Western world, and Norway is one of the country using that power or skill. But unfortunately, it is not being used as a resource. That's a very disappointing thing. I must say that there are so many brilliant minds from Africa. If Norway has to be a trusted and honest and partner to Africans, I think the new strategy has to start with the review of the old strategy and identify if there are some weaknesses and strengths. I think that should be where one has to start. But I know that there are so many very, very nice core values of Norwegian society and Norwegian state. In the same way, societies in Africa have their individual and collective core values. I say individual and collective because in Norway, the society is homogeneous. So it's more or less a collective core value. But in Africa, it's not like that. In Ethiopia, it's diverse community, which has individual core values, but also collective value as a nation. So it's very important to understand this core values. If a Western country has to do a very fruitful engagement, understanding that element is, and also and understanding the needs of those countries is very important to establish a trust and create an environment for a mutual benefit. The notion that Africa is the receiving end is completely wrong. Mm. It's because Africa has the resources, mm-hmm. but lacks the means to use the resource to get out of that sort of problems. So everything is there, but it lacks a system. And we have to question, the West has to question itself that if they have contributed to that, to the all of the chaos that we see in Africa. And of course, we are mosaic, different society layers. Those differences have created a problem for us. Who has, fueled it? That has to be known. For me, I like the Norwegian society because the core value is very important. The values are very important, and the Norwegian society is like giving, supporting those who are in need, and that is the core value. But it's also very important to understand the core values of the African countries. If we can address those issues, then we will find a common way of engaging, not to help Africa, but to mutually benefit. So it's very important to think like that. And sometimes I hear all the time that the Western democracy is perfect for everybody. That's not the way that we understand. Democracy is basic human rights, but it has to be in the context of the core values of the individual countries. So we shouldn't take it as granted that this kind of democracy will can be directly applied in Africa. In my own country, I was born actually just before the king was overthrown. I don't know anything about the king, but I heard a lot of about it. And then I have read, and then I know the history. I grew up in the socialist era regime. And I lived in the last regime. I have never seen that a political system was transferred to the next successive government. It's because that much of the political system is individualistic. It's group-based, not a collective one. So it comes and it disappears. So that was the history.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Shall we say that we take maximum 2 minutes to each person? But it was very good, interesting to hear. And I think that you also, it makes me think that the narrative about Africa has to change, because it's the narrative created by the industry of obese done or corporation is something that comes along with the idea of the one who is giving, the poor, and all that, that is not, that doesn't make sense today as much as it was maybe 100 years ago, or the in the head of the first people who started with that. I think this guy is... Can you please tell your own name?
Karim Sadi. I've been living in Trondheim in 30 years, and I'm friends with Sadiq and Tendai, of course. And thank you for your points. I think you're summing up four perspectives on the issue. That's good. That's mangfold, as they call it here. I have two comments to make. The one is political. It's about your idea of exchanging trade with aid. We need trade, not aid. That was your point. I think Africa has a lot of trade with the rest of the world, the capitalist world and the socialist world too. The problem is equality in the premises of this trade. And equal trade supposes that you have a national government which is able to be an equal partner to their exploiters, because until now they are exploiters. They get uranium, they get cobalt, as Tendai said, they got oil. They get oil from Africa and then turn it into rubber or pens or something like that. And then that's the way they keep Africans as consumers, as not part in the world economy, not active part in the world economy. So you have seen this in the last events in the countries you have been citing now. Niger, Mali before them, and then Omar Bongo family. So you see the French politics in West Africa. When there was a coup in Mali, they stigmatized it as just military junta who wants the power and things like that. Even if they had 5 million supporters in the capital of Mali. And then when you had this in Niger, the happenings in Niger, they were stigmatized in the same way because they were touching the core interests of France in West Africa. With Omar Bongo, who has a richness which can bring his country out of poverty, they excuse him. They even protect him. So I don't think the coup governments in Mali and Niger are democratic or something to have faith in. But I believe in the right to govern their own countries and their own and therefore also their own resources. So the question is that we have some post-colonial governments working with the Western capitalism. That's the core problem. You can say that we also have to assert ourselves, as Tendai was in this theme. We have to assert ourselves, and then comes briefly my other comment. It's about Africans who do it well in Europe. They have to do it well themselves. They have to create their own jobs and things like that. All that is good, but we live in countries which are based on equality and equal opportunities. So the question is discrimination on the work market, and not that Africans do not do it good. Because you have two or three football players in England who sit in with a budget of Niger, apropos Niger. Yeah? So we have artists, we have film people, we have cultural people, they're all doing it very well. But the problem is still that in layer strata of the society, there are a lot of Africans suffering from discrimination from work. So that's a democratic question and not a question of how Africans are creative or not. So that's my other comment. But thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is it? So you want to make a comment to that?
Yeah. I think the aid versus development. Aid versus trade. I don't think I intended to make that kind of distinct, like the shift. I don't want to make that kind of argument. But basically, what I was trying to argue is that development aid is only a fraction of what the relation between Norway and Kenya is, for example. I'm using Kenya for a lot of examples today. Probably because it's my favorite country. But the point is that development aid shouldn't be the center of the Norway-Africa strategy. And I think I forgot to make one point that I was trying to make in my office earlier to myself, is that so when I was saying Norway shouldn't join the race to the bottom movement today, is that, for example, France is protecting this Bongo guy, and China is protecting another dictator somewhere else. If the US is doing that everywhere, it's happening everywhere. And I don't think Norway should join that kind of club of supporting regimes that shouldn't be in power in order to maintain its relation with the country. And that leads to the question of what kind of relations does Norway have with those countries? Is it people-to-people relations, or is it state-to-government, like Norwegian state and another state relations? If it's a state-to-state relations, if it's government-to-government relations, you would want your friendly government to stay in power as long as they want, as long as you want to maintain that relationship. If it's people-to-people relationships, you don't need to guard certain government. You don't need to guard Bongo to stay in power in order to have a friendly relationship with that country. And that's the kind of point that Norway should make itself clear with. And this goes, and I think there is also, because of the green shift and the debates around climate change, there is also a lot of focus on resources, like green resources, critical minerals as input to, because I don't want to forget this point, to input to European green transition. And I have, for some reason, I have been following the Europe-Africa strategy and individual European states strategy to Africa. And in some of the report, like the strategy documents, you see how unconscious people are about how Africans and the diaspora Africans in Europe see the strategies. Because there is one country in Europe which I don't want to mention at this stage, but when you read the first page of the report, the strategy, you can see that country is clearly interested in gaining access to critical minerals in Africa. There is no, they don't make it even subtle enough to hide it. And I don't want the Norwegian document to have that kind of. First of all, I want the Norwegian state to be as honest as possible with how it wants to relate with Africa. But also, I don't want the Norwegian document to have that kind of really clear interest stated on the front page of the document. So there's
that's what example that Norway, we should give aid in the, you don't say offshore industry, but you say something like you mean it, that Norway should follow the technology, to follow the oil, follow the svarte gulle in Africa. It's following that, their own interest. We can read it. You can read it through the lines. So you want it to be clear.
Yes.
Me too. I agree on that. It's very important that we are honest, that Norway is honest about their interests in Africa. Yeah, there are two guys here. I think you are first, right?
Thank you so much for everything, and I'm not well spoken, but I will try to come up with something. The one thing is, often when we hear about a cooperation between countries or something, it's often, it's like they often talk with the politicians, which is right here, and they are really far from the individuals, so they can't identify the problems. What are the problems for the people? So often I see, like, the problems come that far to the politicians, and often the politicians, I haven't seen so many politicians working for the people, especially in Africa. So they all, everything just stays up there, and or it's the money or something like that. So I think it would be nice to work with the, especially with the youth people. They are the one who's gonna they are the future. So I don't see so much like work with the youth people. So I think that would be nice. Other things like Tekla have mentioned, the principles should be like on the line, and I'm worried how if the people which are in Africa don't cheat that principle. You know, often there are principles and they actually cheat the principles or do something, so things don't come to the individual. So how would you do that? Like, how would you solve that problem?
Is it me? Okay.
If you want to comment.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Thank you for the comment. And when I said principles, so for example, the fundamental like principle for me is like human dignity. So a person, whatever they are, whether they are in Trondheim or in Mekelle, they should be treated the same. They are human beings. And if a Norwegian investment in Mekelle, in Tigray, leads to violations of human rights in that place, that aid or development assistance or investment shouldn't take place. The Norwegian system has to have some kind of strategy to follow up what happens to the resources that are allocated, to the resources that a Norwegian company is investing in places that they do. That's what I wanted to say about having like principles.
I don't know. Should I just add something?
If you want, you can.
No, I think I just like to stress on the respect part that most of the aid that is given, be it from government to government or be it through charitable organizations, has to focus more on the respect part, because I know, like he mentioned earlier, that the Norwegian society is a giving society, a caring society. I totally agree with that. But I have every problem with every year, for instance, kids who knock on my door and with this bosh about it, eh? You know, for the sake of Africa, you know, it's Christmas, let's give to, and then the kind of images that are portrayed on national TV, kids with mucus running, flies in the eyes, you know, this is not the image of Africa. These are isolated cases that, of course, need attention, but not in that sort of way, you know. We have respect for children here in the country, where you cannot just come as a journalist and take the picture of a child and put it on national TV. Why then do you take the image of an African child and put it on TV? Does it mean that they are lesser people? That kind of question you should be asking.
That is a very important topic that was stated by Tom Christiansen. Rest in peace, because he died last year. He was very, very critical to that. Kind of how they use children to promote their own interests, because it's an industry. There are so many white people's salaries in this package, and they use this disgusting or very tragic photos to promote their own interests.
Just a little comment on that, because that what you're talking about is a term called poverty porn, as well as as well as poverty propaganda. And it is that showing of an image that then goes into the neural pathways of a person. So whenever you do also see a little African child even walking around in Trondheim, your immediate response is, ah, stakash. And it is, oh, how do I help them? Instead of, again, treating that child with dignity and respect. I wanted to touch on something that you had said, which is what is actually stopping people from going people to people. And I wonder what if Norway is so big on social entrepreneurship and innovation, which is the thing that had first brought me to Norway in 2013 to International Students Festival, which was a course on social entrepreneurship and innovation and development, because I'm passionate about that. In that, what is stopping us from creating initiatives that are from the diasporans in Norway to then hire people on the continent, because that actually takes out administration costs, which is exactly the leak that tends to happen with organizations such as Save the Children, NORAD, and USAID.
Mm. Interesting point. Shall we keep on with the G? Yeah.
Hello, I'm Didrik. I know Sadiq and Tendai. I'm an engineer in medical device, but I'm interested in this topic. I have two questions, I guess mostly to Tekle, but I'd like to hear your opinion too. I think, you know, there's politics tend to make things complicated, and I completely agree with Karim and Tekle and Tendai and Sadiq, you know, on the general, you know, disclosing the power structures at play here. So it's, I don't know how much, I haven't read the Norwegian strategy, the past one, and I don't know the evidence for how much Norway actually followed that through actions. So that's my first question too. I'll just say the next one right away. So my first question is, how did Norway actually follow this strategy, or did they enforce it, or did they ignore things? Did they do other things, and so forth? So there's a huge difference between what, you know, politicians or governments say they will do and what they actually do. So, and it's completely clear through the historical lack of respect through actions from Norway, lack of respect to Africa through actions, that Norway's indirectly and directly participating in the race to the bottom, in the exploitation of resources and the people and human labor. So, you know, there's two solutions to that if you go really back to the, you know, the groundwork. Is Norway chooses to enforce their principles they do at home in Africa. They actually take action on it and do it. And hold corporations accountable, Norwegian corporations accountable, regulate them, punish them if they don't. That's one solution. Another solution is to support coups, as the West call it, in African countries of historical puppets of the West from the colony times. Who has a desire, they, you know, what kind of democracy or power, succession of power they will develop, it should be up to them. Of course, it's not going to be perfect at the first attempt, but Niger tried, and they have the right to regulate their own resources. And we saw a fair price discovery, or they at least took the price from Europe, where it's otherwise extracted and sold. So the second solution is that we have to respect that African countries take control. But if too many African countries do this, they will face enormous pressure from Western, particularly historically Western private corporations, attempting to give weapons indirectly to surrounding countries or friendly oppositions, sanctioned or ignored by Western governments. Can happen in China, but so far you can say no to China and they will not do business with you. They won't militarily intervene. So I'm getting to my end now. So how will Norway react to when enough, if Norway does not enforce their own rules and Africa starts to take control over their resources, we will see Libyan conditions. We will see Congo conditions in other countries, or at least attempts of it. How will Norway hold its allies, so to speak, in the West accountable? Will Norway ignore the US or France going in? Will they say nothing? Will they make it complex? Will they? This should be very clear. So what's your opinion on that? So the first question, maybe you remember, and then the
two major questions. Like I could, this would take like a day to sort of like explain. But I think these are like really, useful questions, and not just for me, but also for the people who would probably use this, the results of this discussion in the drafting of the documents. And I cannot say much about how much has been achieved, off the last strategy, how much has been ignored and how much it has been followed. I haven't followed the assessments of the achievement that were made possible through the last strategy. But there are examples that we could use from the last strategy that I think were very, to a large degree, problematic. For example, we have issues related with climate financing, financing of carbon sequestration programs, plantation and all that. And there is a lot of research regarding how that was basically very problematic, which also goes in line with what Tendai was saying about land dispositions that came up as a result of the financing of plantations by the Norwegian government, which was in connection to climate change. And it was part of the previous strategy to do that. And there are also, I can also give you examples about, for example, how the Norwegian government, despite claims about human rights and fundamental adherence to fundamental principles, didn't follow up on matters. I can give you example of my home region, Tigray, in Ethiopia, where the Norwegian government just acted business as usual when a crime that could easily amount to genocide was taking place, where you have Norwegian finance just flowing like it did the year before, even more during the crisis, which was one of the reasons why I was underlining the importance of sticking to the principles. I don't think any Norwegian in their right conscience would accept the killing of 100 people, let alone hundreds of thousands of people. So, which means Norway didn't follow up on what it promised in the strategy that they had devised before, which shouldn't happen in the next strategy. And that's why I said this has to be clear. And that leads us to your second question. So what should Norway do in a situation where the governments are moving away from the alliance with Western states and sort of going for China, or going to, or what happens when you have a Libya kind of situation? The answer isn't to follow France's footpaths. The answer isn't to follow the US's path in this regard and say, we don't care about human rights, we will just go for resources and collaborate with the states anyway. The answer is for Norway to take a clearer stand. There are examples of states that kind of tend to do that. You can take Ireland, for example, which has a clearer stand on these kind of principles. And Norway has all kind of capabilities of doing that. It's a self-sufficient, strong economy, and it has all kind of diplomatic capabilities to do that. And there is no reason why Norway shouldn't stick to those kind of grounds.
Just to add on to, I think part of the discussion here was how we as the diasporans can help in bettering this document. And I think, keeping the powers that be in check. For instance, nobody knows how this money is utilized. And I'll speak on, as a journalist, we have a whole correspondent from NRCO in Kenya. And I feel very disturbed when I see issues coming from Africa, just negative issues, when there is a war somewhere, there are success stories on a daily basis that are happening in Africa. This can help to, clear this prejudice. It can help to bridge the gap between people. So I look for the day when NRCO can utilize such kind of people also to follow up on these projects, for instance, and find out how much money goes where, how much money was used, was it used in the proper way. All these things we have to be following up. And if the work is too much for him, we've got journalists also in the diaspora who are qualified enough, then he should, get some freelancers to take up the job, So there's a lot that the diasporans can actually put into this.
Yeah.
No, I'm completely in agreement of transparency and transparency along the whole supply chain. But also, Sadiq, I think that you should build diasporic dialogue up until you can actually also hire a journalist on the ground in Kenya that can actually take over the prejudice of like NRK, because I think that there would be a lot more success stories and better information that is coming from there, and people would tune in to what your journalists are saying and training people to the point of of getting to that station. So I'm excited to see your trajectory and where the TV program of Diaspora goes, it can come in.
Yeah, I also want to comment on that, because we have it's a ongoing problem that we have so little space in Norwegian media about Africa, and the small things that are highlighted are almost always negative stories. So it's a big job as a freelance journalist writing about Africa and from Africa. I feel it very urgent to push on that. So we need more people. We need people who have more interest and to write and research about that, all the topics that interest us. But by the way, Sadiq, can you explain us a little bit about diaspora dialogues? Because you didn't explain well how you work and how came the idea all that.
Like I mentioned, we're still in our baby steps now. So. Basically, it's meant to be a YouTube channel where Africans can highlight their issues. Africans in Norway, you know, to showcase to the Africans in Africa that how life in Scandinavia is, you know, because there's always this issue of the grass always looking greener on the other side, you know. So a lot of people, unfortunately, a lot of Africans, this also is something historical, you know, because the regulations, the immigration regulations are so tight, you know, for an African to come to Norway, you have to be asked about the name of your grandmother and your grandmother's mother, and you know, all these things. They make it look like it's paradise on this side, you know. And I remember when I was growing up as a kid, you know, because we always looked at the Hollywood stories, and you know, when you see Europe and you see the Western world, you see the snow, and I was like, oh my God, that is beautiful, you know. But you don't know how freezing it is, you know. That's one thing you do. They don't inform you that it's something you learn the hard way, you know. So diasporic dialogue helps to break down this, to showcase that, you know, life is not as easy as you think here. You have this the climate thing that you have to grapple with. There is the discrimination that you have to fight, you know, being a minority in a country. So that's what diasporic dialogue intends to showcase. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, diasporic dialogues intends to go down to Africa, because I know a number of Norwegians who live in Africa, in Kenya, and they love it. They don't want to come back. You know, to showcase that side of them and why they choose to be there, you know. So it will be sort of like a leverage, you know, for the Norwegians to understand better, aha, so this is what Africa is about. It's not about the war and the hunger, you know, the people celebrating Christmas as usual, you know, there's life going on. It's not just the poverty that we are fed on. So basically that's what diasporic dialogue is. But at the moment you're still in our... baby steps. So I have a few videos and trailers that I've been throwing up here and there, but it should be up and running by the start of next year.
We're looking forward to hear more about it, because it's very, very important to do that. Is somebody who know something about what time it is, and is there some more questions?
I'm sorry. My name is Abu Gaston. I'm from Tanzania. I want to start by maybe responding to a Kenyan presenter who said that he doesn't see if there is any problem with the past Norwegian strategy towards Africa. My question is, if not broken, why would you wish to fix it? Are you going to respond to later? That is one. And then the second one is the heading itself, or the theme itself, I find it is too broad, that Norwegian African strategy. It's too broad. There are so many strategies. Humanitarian strategy, development, investment, trade. But this is too broad. I don't know if we can cover in every aspect. We could even have discussed only one aspect, probably humanitarian aid strategy. So I find it's too broad, and we can't cover anything here. That is second. But if I want maybe to try to go through, according to my experience about Norwegian development strategy in Tanzania, over time, I might say that there is something wrong. There is something wrong, and probably that is what they want to fix it. When I was growing up in the 80s, the Norwegian development strategy in Tanzania was part of what we call it a Nordic Tanzania development strategy. And what was the focus? First of all, they were so supportive to most of the countries that were fighting for their freedom. Mugabe, Tendai Biti, I remember this Tendai Biti, the former minister in Zimbabwe. Mugabe was hosted in Tanzania. South African freedom fighters were hosted in Tanzania, and the major, major funders were the Nordic countries, Norway included. Then, what came after was now how to build the capacity of these poor African countries. Tanzania, for example, where I come from, the Norwegian government introduced these, what we call it here, I don't know, is it pine trees in my region. I can tell you, the living standard in Tanzania, or if you talk about per capita income, the highest region with the highest per capita income is where Norway introduced pine trees, because it's a huge business, huge. We sell timber to Congo, I think even Zimbabwe, to Kenya, everywhere. And then also the Nordic Tanzania development strategy, by then, they came up with another investment. They built a big paper factory in my region, the biggest. When President Moi got the news that Tanzania had the biggest paper factory almost in the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, in 1985, Moi came to my region. And when he saw it, he said, no, I need also this. If you know well, in Eldoret, you have this paper factory. It is because Moi came to my region and he saw this Norwegian investment and he was so, so impressed. That was in the 80s. And then Norway also was so much focused on energy. We have almost like four hydroelectric powers, production facilities, which basically were funded by the Nordic countries, Norway included. We have Norway. The king of Norway, this Harald, he came to Tanzania to inaugurate a transformer factory in Arusha. And this transformer factory, it is very popular. The products are so popular. We sell in Kenya, in Uganda, everywhere. Now, let us look here today. What's happening? What made Norway to be successful? In the 70s, Norway was poor like any other African countries. It was the discovery of what?
Oil.
Oil and gas, isn't it? In Tanzania, we discovered gas many, many years. Norway is very interested. But this is a 10th year we are still discussing on the on the investment modalities. And one would wonder why. You have the magic. You discovered gas and oil in your country, and you know how you how you set the terms that basically benefited your citizens. Why should it take 10 years? That Norway of 1970s and 80s is no longer the same. Take it from me. Then I'll just again pose another question. Sometimes we must be serious a bit. Could really a 5.4 million people country develop a strategy for a 1.2 billion? Serious?
I was thinking about that.
I'm asking so many questions and a little bit. Anyway, now what's the solution? What's the solution? Mm. Someone here is talking about trade. I'm not sure if trade will help. Why? Do you know the value of the coffee, the global value of coffee in the world? It's almost like 600 billion. And do you know how much Africa takes home? Less than a billion, 1 billion. And do you know which country earns a lot from coffee business? Germany, almost 6 billion. Mm. Now, solution is not about like trying to say we need to trade with the Norway or the West. By the way, we can trade among ourselves in Africa, and we can go.
Very good point.
And then yes. we can improve our lives by just trading among ourselves. Yeah. The good example is in the 80s when Zimbabwe had a very, very nice economy, we would buy milk from Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine how many kilometers from Zimbabwe to Tanzania? And I would wonder, is this the product of Zimbabwe? The same as a tea, milk here. That's what we would find in our shelves, and we'll be told that it's from Zimbabwe.
Under the dairy board company.
Yeah, that is one. Second, we need access to finance for us to develop infrastructures. That's what we need. We don't need anything. Go to Uganda. Look in areas where passable roads, tarmac roads, there is a booming business everywhere. We don't need to, let's say, like export anything to Europe in order for us maybe to get forex. We can even get forex within our own region. Lastly, to know that the Norwegian strategy to Africa has basically changed. Look at NTNU. What's the partnership of NTNU? What is the partnership between NTNU and the rest of the world? The focus is India. Focus is China, not Africa. I'm quite for sure. I have my associate professor here. Are you still focusing on Uganda? When I came here, much of the focus, the NTNU focus, was on hydroelectric power, was on energy, and it was Ethiopia, Ghana, Tanzania, and Uganda. And then because something in between here went wrong, now we started to see Norway is developing partnership with Mozambique, a Portuguese-speaking country. And then Angola, we could try to see here students. Why Angola? Why Mozambique? Mm-hmm. I think you might have.
Yes, okay. You maybe got your point.
So I can just end here that there is something broken. That's why there should be solutions for Norwegians. Mm. I don't want to talk about the African diaspora, but because I'm not sure if it exists.
I'm sorry to say that you have to end very soon, but maybe we will, if there are some, yeah, I think that Sadiq, he wants to say something.
I just to correct myself, I don't think I say that there's nothing completely wrong with it. And from what I read, and when I had when I was in touch with the Norwegian council, Hilde, I understood that they only want to better it. They want to better the previous document. And I just perused through it, and I saw there was all these things, self-sustainability, trade, and what. So my only worry was that the approach is what matters here. I mean, I see personally nothing wrong. When you produce, maybe you will agree with me. I don't know whether you've gone through it. I do not know. But I just feel that the approach is what is wrong. You know, I don't know whether maybe you have gone through it and are better able to.
And now again, we have the Labour Party. I can tell you there is a big shift. The Labour Party of before probably is not the same as the Labour Party now. Why? Because it learned a lesson. Why it lost the elections. Why it paved the way for the coalition of parties that basically lost last season, I don't know, last 2 years ago. Much of the focus of the previous government was more only on supporting environments. And from what I know, it was all about the Amazon. So I'm quite for sure, even the Labour Party now here, it is designing this new development or I don't know strategy, not in the same way as before. There should be something to change it.
Just let me say something, some comment on that, and then we're going to conclude here, because it's I'm a little bit pessimistic about the Norwegian. And an environmental approach to Africa too, because as long as Norway has so much interest in the oil industry, it's not moving forward the sustainable development. In Kenya, in Nairobi, 7th September, it was a lot of youth from Africa protesting against take your hands off the Africa, or we are against the neocolonial approach of taking the gas and oil out of Africa. Because they know, as they also say in the Christian Michelsen's Institute in Bergen, in the countries where they have big oil industries, unfortunately, by now, maybe not in the future, but now, it's the richest people and the elite in these countries who's taking the income or the gain of the oil industry. And just as a fun fact, I want to tell you, only from Angola, Nigeria, Libya, and Algeria, Norway pay 32 billion corona in tax for oil from the oil industry. That is a huge amount. That is good that they leave it in these countries, but how much does Norway take out of them? Can you just start to calculate? Is it how many percentage do they leave in tax? And that is the sum is so, it's so mind-blowing, and it's so big compared to what Norway gave in so-called aid, that it's, I just leave it like that.
Only one sentence. Yeah, an article that oil companies are pocketing $3 billion as a profit every day. Every day, $3 billion.
In Africa?
I'm not sure specifically where, but because of the booming of the oil industry, they said that oil companies are pocketing $3 billion per day, not per year, per day.
But is specific? Is that the Norwegian companies in Africa?
No. It's not. Okay, this is very general.
All right. Is it somebody who really want to say something? To comment, and then we have to finish. Then we have to end. sorry, because we could have been talking all night.
Sorry,
we agree on that.
But I just a quick question. Every Western ad money is followed by a Western company. Also, there is a saying where I work: the Norwegian companies goes after the Norwegian ad money. Development of money. So that, this has a consequence, because if the money is coming back due to at the, because the it's the Norwegian company which does the actual work for Africa, even though that the money is from Norway. But the consequence is that project, which was studied by this kind of arrangement, will be abandoned, will not be used by the local, because there is a thinking that this was given and taken back. So is there any kind of statement that is stated in the strategy? That's one thing. The other one is, I see a lot of experts, doing analysis for, specific regions, all from Western countries. But it's very important to also engage the diaspora, so that you will have a balanced information that could be create a workable environment. So trust, mutual respect, and honesty is very important. If you have to make a change, for the betterment of the society. Thank you.
Thank you, all of you. Okay. Is there anybody, or Hilde, do you want to say some? Okay. Then I'll just say thank you, all of you who have been coming today. I say all of you, like, you want to keep on talking. And we are very, very happy to have all of you assisting and participating, and we feel energized by your presence. So thank you very much.
And I feel he was very right to say that it's not enough to exhaust this kind of discussion,
in
1.5 hours. So probably you should do a follow-up so more people can come. And
Definitely. We really need it. We need the input, the work, need the participation in the to be continued, we can say.
Yes.
Collaboration, how it should work between, and strategy between Norway and Africa. And I miss one fundamental thing here, is that any strategy should include people-to-people exchanges, because that's where it happens. Because people know what they need, how they need it, and they have an idea about how it should be. So please, people-to-people connections will be good.
That's a very good point. And then we say people-to-people. No, we have to listen to the needs in the African countries. Then we can start to talk about if there is some kind of cooperation. It's fundamental to know what they need. That's maybe...
No, well, listening and the values and principles and creating the hubs in terms of having those principles actually exercise focus groups and initiatives that come out from those focus groups and incubators, I believe.
Shall we say that we are more or less ending now?
Yeah.
Yeah?